Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is a social media OG. Makeup artist Nicola Chapman is part of a YouTube dynasty, starting the family business with her sister Sam. Together, they pretty much invented the makeup tutorial and the big brand deal, before shockingly, they walked away from it all for an extended time out of the industry. Today, I want to talk about how that break informed what Nick wants now, how her struggles with and treatment for MS have changed her perspective on her profession and self-image, and what she thinks of the content industry she helped to create. But before that, a massive thank you to Clinique, who are sponsoring this series of Beyond the Bathroom. Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. Welcome to the excellent Nick Chapman.
That was very lovely. Thank you very much.
Hello. I'm so happy you're here. Wanted you on for absolutely ages. We are friends in real life, so
yes.
That's very nice. I've never had to do so little research on someone on this podcast ever, because I feel like I know it all. But what is a really nice opportunity is to delve a little bit deeper and maybe get a little bit more personal in our little
room. This is going to be really like a counselling session. I've listened to the others and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be that person that cries. It's like being on the couch.
Did you listen to Sam's?
Yes, I did. I thought it was really lovely.
I found Sam's really... I mean, it seems weird to be starting this podcast talking about Sam because it's not about Sam, but you're very different people and I think it's useful. Sam's was so out of character because it was really intimate and vulnerable,
yeah.
I suppose.
And she's not.
Whereas you don't find it as difficult
no.
to be open and vulnerable.
And what I found interesting is how different we are.
Yeah.
From listening to it, I was like, oh, God. We were brought up in the same household, but we are so completely different people, which is brilliant because then we could both live there and both fit in fine.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would be pushing the other one out, which we did a bit. But I just found it incredibly interesting to listen as an outsider and be like, oh, God, I didn't know that those were your things.
So as you say, brought up in the same house with the same, let's just get to it, difficult upbringing.
Yeah.
For anybody who hasn't listened to Sam's episode or really just wants your perspective on it, talk about that a little bit. What did it look like?
Well, I'm going to go really far back. So growing up, there was me, mum, dad and Sam. There's 3 years between me and Sam. And then when I was seven, my brothers were born. So my brothers were born and my household was always strange anyway. My dad was a proper... narcissistic prick, really. Anyway, he wasn't...
I mean, let's just say...
Yeah, he wasn't a very nice man and we grew up in domestic violence, which I didn't know at the time. Like, you don't grow up knowing that your
Why didn't you know? Because it was hidden from you or because you thought it was just normal and that's
what
went down in families?
It was normal. And when I say DV, that only came later. It was domestic abuse first.
Uh-huh.
So everything was abusive. It was always... belittling us so that he felt like the champion of everything. But the way it was so different is that I was daddy's little girl.
Interesting.
And my sister, because my sister already had mum. Mum was already taken, so I had to fit in with my dad because he was the only one available. So then when I was seven, my brothers were born and he always wanted boys. So I was just pushed to the side completely.
Mm-hmm.
Like he worked away.
And you're in the middle.
And I'm in the middle.
Yeah.
He worked away a lot. So he would come home from working away, be excited to see him. And he'd only bring the kids, the boys, presents. He wouldn't bring me a Sam anything. It was always this little underlying, you're not good enough. Which I actually think has made Sam and I incredibly successful. Because it's like, we'll show you. Do you know what I mean? It was always this... you're not good enough, you don't quite fit the mould, girls aren't as important. There was always this underlying tone with growing up.
Which also, I suppose, is a message to your mother as well, that she's not important because she's a woman.
Absolutely. Mm. So I don't remember beauty growing up.
You don't remember, because it's worth saying perhaps, so I think that you look a lot like your mother. don't you? Your mother, Judy, you can absolutely tell that she's your mother. Yeah. She's a glamorous, beautiful, in that kind of awful, old-fashioned expression, very sort of elegant, well-preserved lady of a certain age. Yes, I mean, she looks amazing.
Yeah.
And so were you not aware of that?
No.
And how glam she was?
No, not at all. I didn't know. But I was not, I didn't even brush my hair. I was literally the feral child that only wanted to do sport and help my dad in the garden and dig ditches and things like that. I was just not, they all used to call me rat's tails because I didn't brush my hair. And my hair ends were like rat's tails, which I actually think is really cool. But, you know, I just had no idea of beauty whatsoever. And it just wasn't important to me in the slightest.
But your auntie was a makeup artist.
Yeah, and that I think this is part of why I am such a dichotomy to myself, because when I was 11, we had to write what we want to be when we're older. And I wrote, I don't even know where this must have come from, and I've still got it. I drew some brushes that look exactly like the Real Techniques brushes.
Wow.
And I've written beside it, when I grow up, I want to be a makeup artist. Where would that have come from? Obviously, from my auntie, it must have been something in the distance, but I was just starting high school and I wasn't into beauty in any way whatsoever.
Do you think there was something about your auntie's life that felt free and nice and happy and productive, perhaps?
It just felt like escape.
Yeah.
Because she lived in London.
Yeah.
She lived a different life to us.
Uh-huh.
I didn't realise I wanted to escape, but you often don't when you are younger. You don't realise what's going on. And the funniest thing is, me and my sister both have had friends at school. I'm still friends with them. Had a certain friend, one was her age, one was mine. And I remember going to my friend's house for a play date and I saw her parents kiss. And I was like, what is that? It felt so wrong to me. Mm-hmm. And my sister has exactly the same experience. But when she went there 3 years in advance, and I was like, that's...
You both had the same observation.
We both were like, what is this? This is so weird, because there was no love or emotion in our household.
Intimacy of that moment.
We didn't have that. You know, my mum still struggles to cuddle us now.
Aww.
She is incredibly loving. I think she just doesn't always like remember to give, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But can she give to her grandchildren? Because I always find it skips, doesn't it? That's where they can settle into it.
Absolutely.
And that's where it's safe to kind of scoop up grandchildren.
And I often think, what age does that cut off?
Yeah.
What age do you not get those cuddles anymore?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I still give mine cuddles all the time, but, you know, it's different. I just don't want them to have what we had.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, they become faintly embarrassed of cuddling you for a bit, and then they come back with a vengeance. Mine are very much back
on the
cuddle front. Yes. Yes, they're not weird about it. I also think cuddles are a little bit like medicine. You might not want to take them, but they're ultimately good for you.
They are.
And so you've got to kind of force them on your children a bit.
Absolutely. Edie always wants cuddles, whereas Harry, he still does, but I wouldn't do it in front of all of his mates anyway. He's 13. But he's not like that, I don't love my mum. He will say in front of his mum, in front of his mates, I love you so much, mum. I'm like, cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
So you can't remember people doing that thing they do with pretty little girls, going, oh, you're so pretty, or you're so beautiful. It just felt like a completely separate thing.
Yeah, I don't remember it at all. I don't remember, maybe I've shut it out. I do not remember at all. I remember my mum and dad used to run pubs, being in a pub and sitting on some old guy's knee, and he paid me 50p.
Wow.
Now I think, oh my God.
There was a lot of that weirdness in those days. I mean, there is now, but in a different way.
Yeah, and I remember him being like, oh, if you sit on my knee, I'll give you 50p.
Yeah.
But I don't think that was for any beauty reason. It was
I doubt it had anything to do with you.
I doubt it.
So when did you put that kind of arbitrary thing about, oh, well, I'm just going to be a makeup artist despite not really having an interest or knowing anything about it. When did that go into practice then?
Well, when I was 11, I wrote that I wanted to be, but then, you know, I'm not academically, as they would say, advanced. Creatively, I am incredibly advanced. And for sport, I am very good. And I just went for whatever was... Look, my mum and dad were going through a divorce when I was picking my GCSEs and doing my GCSEs. My dad was in jail for domestic violence for some of it, and then wasn't allowed to see us. So I didn't have any support through any of this time, and that is not detrimental to my mum in any way. I was quite happy to do it myself, and I've always been that person that just wants to do everything themselves, much to my fault, actually, now since having counselling. So I only chose things that I wanted to choose, mm-hmm. which is things I was good at, which is what I'm encouraging my son to do now. Mm-hmm. Just pick what you're good at, because that's what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So I picked art and I picked sport, and then loved art, did well in my only thing I did well in GCSE for, and then managed to get into a college to do makeup afterwards. So it was kind of like, okay, what are you good at? You've kind of been left on your own, just go do it.
And were you wearing makeup yourself at this point?
I had started to. I remember when I started school, high school, putting foundation on, and my sister was 3 years older than me, so was in the fourth year, going up to the fifth year, and I remember her calling me over and laughing at me because I looked like Casper the Ghost because I had such pale... This is a rite of passage. This is not getting at my sister. She taught me to be a stronger person for it, but you know when you're standing in front of everyone. But no one would cross me.
So you had white around it, like Snazaroo. Can you remember Snazaroo in the compact?
I think it was Rimmel or Max Factor pancake in that was... obviously porcelain or vanilla, I would say, but when it was like white. Mm-hmm. And she called me over and
full of talc.
Yeah, embarrassed me in front of everyone. But that's all part of it. But I was just trying to dip my toe in and see what I wanted to, you know, what makeup would look like on me as such.
And did you see those sorts of comments as a challenge where you thought, right, well, I'm going to make it look
better?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Everything was a challenge and probably still is in my life. But it was always like, okay, I won't have that happen again. How can I make that better? What can I do that's better? And, you know, actually my sister's taught me a lot of lessons on the journey as well. Like I used to make her, as I got older, I used to make her put my false lashes on for me mm-hmm. when I was like 16, 17, because mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. And then she was like, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm so fed up with it. So I did it. And then I became absolutely brilliant at putting false lashes on and doing liner because she wasn't going to do it for me anymore.
Yeah.
Like, so it teaches you a lesson to just get on with it yourself.
And how did it make you feel, that kind of sense of transformation when you put a face on? Because I sometimes think makeup is a form of escape in itself, right? You sit there and there's just you and some products, and an hour later you can look completely different, be a different person, feel a different way.
I loved that escapism, and it's still my escapism.
You're still a bit like that, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. On a Saturday when everyone's in the house, I take myself off and I'll just go and put makeup on, just enjoy it. And I used to do that a lot. It was an escapism from everything that was going on in life, all the problems that we had. You know, me and mum and my brothers, my sister was living in London, had to go and live with one of mum's friends in hiding so our dad couldn't find us. Mm. So we did that for a year, and it was just my escape. Was to go off and just put makeup on or just feel more grown up and feel like I had my shit together, really. You know, I was only 14, 15, but it was the only thing I had that was mine because we lived in someone else's house. So I'd take my makeup, I shared a bed with my mum.
Wow.
I mean, through I was going through my GCSEs, we had nothing because we were escaping my father. So, you know, you do have these things that have just become a habit of an escape and just, this is my happy place and that is mine. It's absolutely mine. Anything creative. I'll sit and draw with the kids if they want to. Just anything that takes your mind off of life.
Do you experience that flow state where you're just not really sure what time it is? 2 hours could have passed, 45 minutes could have passed, because you're just lost in the task.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would be up there all day long unless Ian was like, Nick, you're coming back down. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
But I would just be there all day long. And that could be just moisturising and plucking my eyebrows and just, you know, losing yourself in whatever you happen to be doing.
And so in time, you did get your independence and mm-hmm. your financial independence. You worked on counter.
Yeah.
I think Estee Lauder first, then MAC.
Yeah.
Like lots of the best makeup artists started on counter with real people, real faces.
Yes.
What did that counter experience give you, not just professionally, but personally, I suppose?
Confidence, especially, you know, I went the route of I went to Estee Lauder because I knew a Mac was coming to Norwich, which is where I was living. So I went to Estee Lauder in boots and became counter manager so I could learn all the stuff you needed to do and do a bit of makeup. And I was still doing freelance in my spare time, you know, brides and whatever jobs came to Norwich. And then 6 months to a year later, Mac came and I became assistant manager there. And it was just the group of people. It felt free. It felt like, oh, you're like me. You know, oh, you love makeup as well. But also people that loved a brilliant time as well. And I think that was it. It was that moment in the early noughties where it was just full of people that just wanted to have the best time of their life.
It's, I try and explain to my husband sometimes because he's never done a job like that. It's a real family retail.
Yeah.
Because you work these funny hours, you're united by people who are very often horrible to you.
Yeah.
Bit customers are very horrible to you. And so you're in this family where it's kind of you against them and you're dealing with these people. You're working these strange hours. You're going out after work, dragging yourself in the morning after a big night out. It's a really close community.
Because you're all the same. You know, you're all trying to do the same thing. You all love creative, but you're also all absolutely knackered and trying to find how to get out of working in retail at the same time so that you can have more time to be more creative and not have to follow these strict rules of having to be 9 till 6 or whatever it was. But you're kind of stuck in this never-ending wheel of loop of, right, go to work, go to the pub, go out, go home, sleep for a few hours, go to work, go to the pub. And that was literally on repeat. That was it.
Yeah.
Which was brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, I had a great time.
Yeah. I was so much better at eyeliner after I'd had my lunchtime glass of wine. I could sail sand to the desert right now. I'm amazing.
I often think that people who worked on counter make the best content creators. I mean, we've seen it time and time again. If you look at sort of megastars within the field, not just you and Sam, but Jamie Genevieve, Estee Lauder counter, Cher Webb, Mac.
With me, yeah.
You know, Hannah Martin, Bobby Brown. Mm. There is something. Adeola was Pat McGrath and Bobby, wasn't she, Adeola? There is something about the counter experience that makes you, I think, better able to communicate with normal women. Was that your experience? Did you pick up those kind of skills there?
Yeah, I would say. I hadn't really thought about it like that, but definitely because you're having those questions coming in constantly.
Yeah.
You know, I think content has moved dramatically now to everything is quick and there's no education in it. And that's fine. That people have a shorter retention, the people that are watching it now, more so the younger ones as they come through. Whereas I can't change the education. I need to put in because otherwise I feel like it's pointless to put it on there as such. So I think from having people come to counter and say, can you teach me this? You know what you got on your face, put it on mine, exactly like that. You know, that's what it taught you. And it taught you different skin tones and different colourings and all the things that you just don't learn anywhere else. You know,
I also think anyone can make a model look gorgeous.
Oh my God, put a warm flannel on them. And they're amazing.
No, it's true. Yeah. If you're on a shoot and you're only dealing with like 16-year-old models, of course they look great. Yeah. You could turn up with two things in your kit.
They've been booked because they already look great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't have to do anything. Whereas when you have someone come in who is struggling with hair loss or anything, you can redraw their brows on. You can teach them so much stuff that you wouldn't necessarily get to. People that have acne and they're like, I just feel so insecure.
Yeah.
Those are the things that you can teach and those are the memories that you have that you take away and be like, wow, I love my job for that.
They're totally the gratifying moments, aren't they, those?
Yeah.
Years and years ago, I did a thing with Bobby Brown about foundation. And one of the case studies I was working with, said to me afterwards that she'd had sex with a light on for the first time in years because of her foundation covered her acne. I'll never forget that. I thought, oh my God, that is massive.
And they're the things that we don't even think about.
Yeah. I mean, it's massive, but that's kind of the power of beauty, I think, in a real way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, that stuff really matters. At which point in this whole journey did you realise you were not very well?
After I had my son, Harry, so he's now 13, every time I went to shave my underarm, you know, you look down to shave, every time I went to shave it, I couldn't see properly. It felt all blurred. And I was like, I don't know what that is. Must be something to do with having kids. I am that person that's just like, oh, never mind. And then I went to the doctors eventually and they said, oh, you've got optic neuritis. I was like, okay, don't know what that means. Doesn't matter to me. Then I went, after I had my daughter, I was working loads. Work was so busy.
At this point, you're already a big deal on the internet. You have real techniques.
It was crazy. I went to a launch of something and I woke up in the morning and I'd been definitely working too hard and I'd been training really hard as well. I woke up in the morning, I was completely blind in my left eye.
Wow.
And I said to my husband, I can't see out of my eye. Is there something in it? Like, what's going on? And he was like, no. I still went out that night. And then carried on, put up an Instagram saying, oh my God, I can't see out of one of my eyes. Who does that? Do you know what I mean?
What year would this have been if you put it on Instagram?
This must have been 2014.
Okay.
I'm going to say it was 13
or 14. 11 years ago.
Yeah. Went to the doctors and they were like, oh, no, actually my friend Renee, who's a doctor, messaged me and said, why are you blind? What's going on with your eyesight? And I was like, I don't know, I've lost vision in it. And she's like, right, okay, can you go and get an MRI or something? Because you have to take these things seriously. She's a doctor, far more serious than me. And I was like, yeah, sure, why? And she's like, because that can be linked with MS. I was like, oh, Ian, I've got MS. My dad had MS.
So you already knew that your father had MS.
I knew instantly.
Had you always had a nagging feeling?
I knew that I was going to get it.
Did you?
I remember being in a car with a girl. I don't know what, she wasn't even one of my friends, it was just an acquaintance. We were going to pick up something and driving along and she was talking about MS because her auntie had MS and then someone else in her family had MS. And I was like, oh, I didn't think it was hereditary. And she said, oh, it's not, but it can be. And I thought in that car, cool, I'll probably get MS. I'll get MS. I mean, you just think. So it wasn't even a shock to me. It was just something that I hadn't even thought about because I hadn't seen my dad for so long. So then I went to the doctors, went through all the long procedures to find out, spinal block, all the things. And then they said, yeah, you've got quite a few lesions on your brain. So you have relapsing and remitting multiple sclerosis. So I cried it was Edie's first birthday party.
I mean,
the day before,
a lot.
On the Sunday, and I had the doctor's appointment on the Monday, and that's when they told me. So it would have been the 1st of March.
How did you feel in that moment? That's a lot.
I felt really sad for Ian because his mum died of cancer and he nursed her. He really looked after her and he's always such a carer and looks after people. And I was like, oh, fucking hell, you're going to have to look after me.
Yeah.
And it was just pure guilt that I don't want you to spend your whole life caring for people. So we went home. We thought about it.
I mean, it is what he does, though.
He is such a carer.
It is what he is.
Yeah. And he loves doing that.
Yes.
We went home. And he was like, right, let's do some research. I was like, I'm not doing any research. I'm not doing anything. I'm just going to ignore it. He did all the research, found out everything there was to find out, while I just sat in the corner like, I hate my life, but nothing I can do. Don't want my kids to see me in this position, so I've just got to carry on and plow on through. And then he was like, right, we're changing your diet, we're doing this, we're doing that, and we just did, and that was it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm barking at the wrong tree here, but there's a couple of things going on there. Firstly, you hear about what is, by any measure, a really, really difficult thing to live with, for anyone to live with, and you're worrying about your husband and your kids and everything. But at the same time, it's a condition you have acquired from your worst person in the world.
Yes, the only thing he ever gave me.
Right. So that's complicated.
Yeah.
Because it's a shitty thing to happen.
Yeah.
But also it's another shitty thing given to you by a shitty person.
Yeah. But for me, my dad was the most negative criminal that you could possibly imagine. He was prolifically cheating on my mother and just an awful, awful human in general. And I just wasn't going to take the same path as him. That was absolutely not going to happen. He's only given me, like, he had a great character and was a real people's person, as quite often these people
charisma.
Are. Charisma. Charisma. And I was like, I'm only taking the charisma from you.
Uh-huh.
I'm not taking anything else. I am not going to be that person that allows MS to take over them. So it was just a not happening ever. That was, you know, that was my outlook on it. I will not be like you.
Thank you to our wonderful Beyond the Bathroom series sponsor, Clinique. At Clinique, you'll find dermatologist-guided solutions for your skin type and your skin goal. From the original Clinique computer to today's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool, Clinique has always helped you to understand your skin and its specific concerns. Clinique's consultants are educated in partnership with dermatologists and are always on hand, either online or in selected stores. I've met and worked with dozens of these consultants by this point, and they are second to none in terms of their knowledge and passion for skin. Clinique skincare and makeup products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Thanks again to Clinique, where great looking skin begins.
You are a relentlessly positive person, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you are.
Yes.
You are always, you're quite businesslike about things. You're a bit, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this. I've got a plan.
Yeah.
And so you did have a plan. What did you change? You say you changed your diet.
Changed diet, changed alcohol intake, changed pretty much everything.
Yeah, you're not really a drinker, are
you? No, changed everything and just thought, okay, these are the things I can do. I went to see the doctors to find out what drugs I could take. I've never taken drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I don't want to take drugs. So we decided to do it with vitamins and, you know, like looking after myself and how we eat, because I didn't want to take something because my sister told me when I was younger, I had a dream that you took drugs and you died of an overdose.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, so then I never took drugs. So I missed that fun boat as well. And I was like, why me? I'm like literally, apart from alcohol, I'm literally the cleanest person there is.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so I just changed loads of stuff and it was fine for a really long time.
And then when was it not?
In lockdown, we had a lot going on with work anyway. My sister had been a little bit depressed for a while. And often the person you're with the most, you take it out on. So she was quite mean to me and didn't like me for a while. And I just had so much.
We talked about this during Sam's episode, so you're not speaking out of school.
Oh, okay, I didn't want to.
No, she talked about she'd gone through her depression during that.
Yeah, she
everyone went a bit mad, didn't they?
Yeah, she had real depression. This was before lockdown even. And I was working with her so tightly that I was the enemy. And I think for a long time, she hated how happy me and Ian are
mm-hmm.
because she didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I had MS, so she had no reason to be jealous of me. It was such
feelings aren't rational.
Yeah,
it was
irrational. And then we decided to stop for a while, and then lockdown happened. And there was just so much stress that my MS just got so much worse. You know, I would. It's not homeschooling that did it. It was all the other stress, although homeschooling was impossible.
Yeah, fabulous.
No, it was all the other stress. And I just got vertigo for months and I couldn't walk very far. And I said to Ian, my MS is progressing. I don't know if this is relapsing or remitting anymore. I think I might have moved to the next step. I can't walk. I could hardly walk. And everyone was allowed to do social walking. And I was like, I can't.
Yes, that's a horrible thing.
Yeah, I can't walk anymore. And my thing was always sport.
Yeah.
And I can't do any of those things.
Yeah.
So I looked into what I could do that wasn't taking drugs. And I looked into stem cell transplant, which is what I decided to do.
So what you did was quite radical.
Yeah.
So, and let's precursor this by saying, one of the things that I love about you is that you absolutely have owned your privilege at every step of the way.
Yeah.
You were able to do this because you could afford the vast amount of money it cost.
Yep.
And what you would like is for people who don't have money to be able to access this treatment. So let's say that.
Well, after I came back from paying for my treatment, I spent £5,000 on getting a publicist to try and make the treatment available in the UK of my own money, like which I wasn't getting any press for, but just to try and make
and I it know available. In private, this was your goal. This was something that was very, very, very important to you. It was quite a big thing, though, for you personally, what you did. So we were at Sam's wedding.
Yeah.
Lockdown had finished.
Yeah.
We were all at Sam's wedding and I mean, it was one of the most emotional scenes I've ever been part of. It's kind of mid-evening on Sam's wedding. You had to say goodbye to everybody because you were flying out the next morning with Ian to go and do what?
Have HSCT, which is basically my own stem cells killing me off and giving me back my own good stem cells to hopefully help my autoimmune multiple sclerosis to stop attacking myself.
So it was about stopping it in its tracks.
Yeah.
You can't reverse it.
You can't cure it.
Can't do that. But you can try and halt
its
progress.
You can try and stop it. You can try and stop your body from fighting itself. I can't get anything back that I lost.
Sure.
But I can reboot and stop. And that was the plan. Look, I'm not against Western drugs at all. But I wanted to try something that I could say, I don't have it anymore. And I can never say that, but I can feel within myself that I don't have those MS things going on anymore that you have.
And so what did the treatment look like? You and Ian moved away. You were gone, what, a month?
A month.
Yeah.
So I looked into when I could have it done. I didn't want to have it done before Sam's wedding because I really wanted to be at Sam's wedding.
Of course. Well, you gave her away.
So I gave her away and did a speech and I was like, that's not a thing. But I didn't want to hold on for too long because I was already losing so much to my MS. So I said to Sam, I can go the day after your wedding, but it means I have to leave at your wedding. What do you mind? She said, I don't mind at all. I said, well, let's not make it a big thing. We won't tell people. Obviously, people then.
In the end, we were all sobbing.
Everyone knows, yeah. I said, do you mind? She said, not at all. I said, I just won't be there for the evening. So I did my speech. That's why I was incredibly emotional during the speech.
It was beautiful.
I was emotional anyway, but I was more so because I knew I didn't know what the outcome would be. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, you know, you don't even know if you're going to survive that. Mm-hmm. So played with the kids a little bit. And then Ian and I got in the car to go to the airport, to go to Mexico to have my stem cell transplant, which was a month of intensive chemo, re-giving my stem cells back, loads of injections to extract the stem cells from my bone marrow so that I create more stem cells.
So you lived in hospital?
I lived in an apartment that was, and then only when it was chemo would they take us out to have the chemo. And then Ian and I had to be isolated and just be with each other.
And then when you came home, there was a further extended period where you had to live in isolation. Luckily, we were a little bit used to that at that point. But you had to live in isolation so that you didn't catch a cold, so that you didn't catch some kind of virus.
Well, when I was having my second round of chemo, I had 2 years worth of chemo in 2 days. So as I arrived, you have a massive health check to check that you're even able to have this procedure done. As I was having my second round of chemo, Mexico went on the red list, so we couldn't get home.
Oh, okay.
So I said to Ian, Ian was like, Mexico's just gone on the red list, which means you have to stay in a hotel when you get back. Mm-hmm. You have to quarantine. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't think about that, Ian. That's you. So he spent the whole month making sure that we wouldn't have to quarantine. And then on the last day, it was a bank holiday the next day, we got an email to say, you're exempt, you can go straight home. So we managed to make it all the way home, but we got escorted through the airport anyway on the way home because of what I'd been through. And then I got home and we had to wait until my immune system was back strong enough before we could join in with anyone. But luckily, my bloods came back really quickly. So I only had a couple of weeks that I couldn't see anyone. And then my bloods were back to good.
And it has been extremely beneficial to you, that treatment, hasn't it? Where are you at now?
So far, I have no new lesions. Every time I have an MRI, it's like, oh God. But there's no new lesions. I don't have the pain inside anymore that I had. Like there's certain things that you have with MS, your vision. My vision is still not great, but I don't have the hug that I used to have anymore. I still can walk the exact same amount as I could before, which is 2.5 miles. But it's not got any worse than that.
Because let's be realistic. I remember you and I having a conversation about this before your treatment. You were going to end up unable to walk at all.
Absolutely.
You were going to end up in a wheelchair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not just the wheelchair. It's the brain. If it starts attacking your brain and starts attacking your speech. And, you know, it's literally like a slowly taking away everything that you have disease. And it was getting worse. And I knew it was, which is why I did something so drastic. And touch wood, so far, it... And we don't know how long it will last, but I'll take whatever.
And it was an amazing journey to be on. Do you know what I mean? Losing your hair and all the stuff that came with it has all been like, wow, this is incredible to try all this stuff and experience things.
I wonder how it sort of changed your perspective on what you do. So all of this took place, as you said, you and Sam had kind of come to the end of the road. You had this huge deal with Real Techniques that was maturing, and you had the opportunity to walk away from it and make some changes in your life, and you took them.
Yeah.
So you left the industry, you retired, you closed your YouTube account, you know, everything kind of stopped really suddenly. And then you had your treatment. What did that break from this industry show you about what you loved about it, what you hated about it, what you missed, what you didn't miss?
It did show me how much I loved it. Well, it showed me that I love makeup and the process of beauty. And if there happens to be a camera in the background at the same time and I make content with it, then brilliant. I missed that. I missed my friends and you know, and that's part of it, because when you've worked in this industry for so long, you do become friends with so many people.
Yeah.
So I missed that. I didn't miss feeling like I had to do a certain thing at a certain time, you know, like I didn't miss the travel with Real Techniques. It was a lot and it was really straining on both Sam and I. So I didn't miss that. Although now...
Didn't miss standing in a Florida Walmart.
No, exactly. I didn't miss that. I didn't miss those things, but I look back at them with such fond memories now. But I, you know, just having a year out, which is what I had, it made me realise how much I love it over anything. It didn't, you know, I really did miss it, and I missed my identity, and I missed that I get to do what I love. So that's what I, you know, the main things I missed, things I took away from it that were great were being with my children at such a crucial age, you know, and now I look at my sister having to leave when her kids were this age.
Yeah.
And I don't know how she did it. I understand why she disliked me at the time and all that, because mine were babies. But
also, she was a single mother. She was You're a single hustling, mom. Aren't
yeah.
you?
And yeah. And she and hers were my kids' age now.
Yeah.
And they need you more. When they're teenagers, it's crazy how much they need you.
They need you in a very different way.
They need you to not be present, but be completely present at all time.
Yeah. They need you to be there so they can ignore you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just so that they know that you're breathing the same air as them, but they want to make it really evil air. Like, I want to make you really upset and cry, but you need to be there.
No, you're like delivery. You need to just be on call all the time.
Yeah. So I realised how difficult that it would have been for my sister more so. I'm very lucky in the way that we did it round is that mine were babies and didn't really need me as much when they were that age, and they now they do. But I feel like I have a really good balance now. I don't do as much. I make sure that if I'm going to be in London at events, it's ones I really want to go to.
Yeah.
Or I say, just send me the product, and if I love it, I'll do a video.
I mean, yeah, that's me. If I could go to nothing.
And I know that probably doesn't give me as much work as I would have got if I'd went to them, but also I don't want to. I don't want to. I want to go to the netball matches and the football matches, and I want to be around my house and just... You know, I like my routine. I get up and I train with my brother, and I love those things that I am very fortunate.
What frustrates you about social media? Because, I mean, you've seen it in every guise. You've seen it at every point in its evolution.
Nothing. I don't think anything. It frustrates me that I don't get more views. I find that frustrating. But then I'm probably not relevant to many people. I don't find it massively frustrating, because I've made it work for me. I would have, but I just don't anymore, because it doesn't matter so much. If people want to tune in, then great. If they don't, then fine. Do you? I mean, so I don't... There's nothing I really dislike so much about it. But I was thinking the other day how funny that Sam and I were on the forefront of social media with beauty brands. And I remember going... having a day where we went around all the PRs, and we went to Dior, and we went to YSL Beauty head office and said, please, can you give us products? We're doing this thing. We don't know how successful it will be, but we'd love it if you could support us and we can use your products in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first brand that ever worked with us was Chanel, which is crazy. But I just think how far it's come that people are sent so much stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Sam and I knocking on the door saying, please look at us. Please listen to us. I think this is going to be big. And now it's just posted. So much stuff that I do look back and smile, feel like I was at the start of something that was quite amazing.
Tell me how it feels to have aged on camera. And I mean that about all of us. I mean, you look fantastic. But we all started appearing in magazines or on the internet or whatever it is we were doing a long time ago. And I have seen, as you will have done, myself age year on year in an industry where that stuff is arguably important, or maybe it's changing. I don't know. Maybe we can talk about that. But how has that felt? Where does aging sit with you and aging publicly?
Love it. Absolutely love it. I feel better as I've got older. Now, this is not to say that I won't one day have a facelift, because it is on my mind rather than anything else. But I love it. I feel I look better than I did when I was younger.
Yeah, you do.
I feel like my face was rounder and I didn't have the shape there. I really enjoy aging. I feel really privileged to get this opportunity. And, you know, I have Botox just because I like it. And I like it makes makeup easier to put on. It lifts
my
brows.
We've got the same doctor.
Yeah, it lifts my brows.
We'll pop him in the show notes.
Well, seems amazing. And he does it so subtly. You know, I'm not that person that doesn't talk about the stuff they've had done. But I just love it. I just really enjoy aging on camera. I don't mind at all. I will sit there with no makeup on. I'm quite secure in how I look.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas years ago, I wouldn't have had that security. When I was younger, I wouldn't leave the house without makeup on. I went through a stage where it was so important to me to have my brows on, you know, because we plucked them all away. It was so important. And I understand, because I would have just been a big round thing with no brows. But I feel like this is what social media has taught us, that it's fine and that we look fine.
It's funny, isn't it, the no makeup thing, because people outside of the industry frequently say to me, oh my God, like, I can't believe it. Sometimes I look at your Instagram and I can't believe you stood there in no makeup. And I did one recently where I had a rash on my face. And I'm like, you only have to do it once and then you never think about it again.
Yeah.
Like, the first time you do it, you maybe feel a little bit naked. I can't even remember. But you never feel it again. Once everyone's seen you without your makeup on, they've seen you. It's
done.
How
are you going to teach people to put makeup on if you start with makeup on?
Yeah.
It just makes no sense to me.
Or filters.
And actually, big up to the people that follow that say, you look great with no makeup. Because they're the people that make you have the confidence. You get the odd little person that wouldn't back in the day. It doesn't really happen so much anymore, because I don't really tend to get trolled so much as I used to. But people really want to big you up. A lot of people will be like, I love that. Well done. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's really nice. If you only see the negative, then you won't see those lovely bits as well.
I think that's really true. It's human nature, isn't it? I was talking to a celebrity one day and she was saying that she noticed over time on Instagram that somebody would say something really, really nasty to her and she would respond to them. And meanwhile, there were 50 people saying a nice thing who she didn't respond to, because that didn't sit so comfortably with her to respond to a compliment, but she was able to respond to an insult. And one day she just realized, what the hell am I doing? I'm rewarding like weirdos who want to upset me, and I'm ignoring lovely people who want to encourage me.
Yeah.
And that's all wrong.
It is interesting though, because I think we do that in person. When someone says, you look lovely today, you go, oh, so do you.
Yeah.
Rather than say, thank you so much, that's really nice of you.
Yeah.
I make it my habit now, and I will often give a compliment anyway, because that's just but I will also say, thank you so much. I appreciate your compliment and I take it on board and I really am grateful of that.
Yes, because the impulse for British women and Irish women as well, I think, is to fight the compliment.
Yeah.
Is say, this is from Primark, or, oh yeah, no, but I've got a cold sore.
You know, point out the negative.
Exactly, to try and argue against it. And actually, although people do it because they're feeling unconfident, it's actually not great manners.
No.
What you should do is take it.
Yeah.
And go, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. You look lovely too.
Yeah.
You know, but just own it and take it back. And I think
Maybe that's something that social media has taught me as well, is to just be like, great, I'm really pleased that they have taken that on board. And they've, and I honestly also don't mind constructive criticism.
Mm-hmm.
If I haven't done something a way someone would have said and they point it out, I don't find that trolling at all.
No.
I really,
well, that's not
trolling. No, it's not. It's kind of saying, oh, you know, and I'm like, do you know what? You're right. I really appreciate that. Thanks for spotting that out for me. Do you know what I mean? I think...
I always think the acid test is, would you say this in real life?
Yeah.
If you would make this constructive criticism in real life, then great, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you wouldn't say this in real life because it's rude and disrespectful and deliberately triggering, then no.
Yeah, you're just a prick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you're just an arsehole.
Yeah.
Absolutely that. What respect, I suppose, following your treatment and the aging process, but also your treatment, what respect have you found for your body? Has your relationship with your body changed as a result?
Oh, yeah. I went through this real, and I am a bit of a hippie inside kind of spiritual person anyway. And whilst I was having my treatment done, I was like, oh my God, I'm so grateful to my body for inhabiting me. You know, mm-hmm. this vessel mm-hmm. that's keeping my spirit in there, mm-hmm. I will leave that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my belief, is that I will leave that and go on to other things, whatever they are. And this is just, and I'm so grateful for it to put up with me at lunchtime having my glass of wine and the things that I did. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So I became very grateful and decided that I wanted to do good for my body in return. So I make sure I train, I look after myself. And those are the things that really came away from it is, okay, I don't want to misuse my body so badly anymore. And I want it to represent the same, my inside to represent the same as how this looks outside. Remember when I first had counselling and I went in and I was like, oh, for God's sake, what's this going to be like? But all my siblings had had it. So I was like, I don't want to be the only one that's not. And I went in and she said, okay, describe, you're a boat, describe your boat. And I was like, oh my God, it's like a yacht and it's really, really beautiful and it's really clean and tidy and it's gold and this and this. And she said, okay, and what's it like on the inside? And I was like, oh, shit, she's good. Because I was like, it's broken. Everything is falling to bits inside. And that's the first time I've really thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And now I want to have a really, really beautiful boat inside as well, not just on the outside. I want it to be fixed and polished and working. And you think you get there and then you get bloody shingles. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Like, I should say, as we're recording this, Nick is recovering from shingles.
Mm-hmm.
Quite but miserable.
In my positive outlook, as I do have, and someone said this to me the other day, why do you always find the positive? My autoimmune go-to is MS.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the one that would be triggered when I'm stressed or when I run down. I got shingles. That's not MS.
Mm-hmm.
So my autoimmune response this time was not to flare up MS. Mm-hmm. It was to flare up shingles. So I'll take it. I will have
MS
that.
Is not the daddy anymore.
It's not winning anymore. It's not even relevant anymore.
Uh-huh.
Shingles came out, which is really shit, really painful, but I can get over it.
That, I mean, that's such a you way of looking at things. But yeah, I get it.
That's what I thought. I was like, oh my God, MS wasn't even in the picture.
I always ask guests what they think when they look in the mirror, but I want to ask it to you slightly differently. A couple of years ago, you and I did a job together and you... in an old-fashioned way as a makeup artist on a shoot, which I know occasionally you like to do if there's time or whatever. And I remember you saying to me, oh, it's so nice to do this. I'm bloody sick of my own face.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Because as a content creator, you're not just looking into a camera at your own face, but you're also editing the bloody thing and you're listening watching it upload and you're converting it and you're just staring at your own face throughout the whole process. Tell me about that and how that makes you feel.
I don't even picture it anymore. Do you know what I mean? You just go through the motions and you don't even realise it's you. I realise that I say so much stuff wrong. You know, like pronunciations and things like that. And I'm like, oh my God, but that's just me. It is boring always doing your own face, which is why I try to do slightly more creative things. Because if I look at my reel when it all looks the same, I'm like, I am bored of myself.
Yeah.
Other people must be so bored of me.
Uh-huh.
So I do try to keep myself sane by doing, which I actually am due to do a more creative something, to do more creative stuff just so that I don't get bored of my own face. Because it is boring.
It is, because it's the same set of eyes, it's the same skin type, it's the same nose.
And then you could go to a point where you start picking fault in those things. It's like, let's not do that. Do you know what I mean? Because you'd end up having so much done that you'd then regret because you miss your old face.
I know that in private, when you're not working, you like to be really low maintenance.
Yeah.
So we were talking about festivals, weren't we, the other day, because it is... a fact about you that you love a festival.
Love them.
You love to sit in your own filth for three days and have a great time. Is it about that? Is it freeing?
Yeah, I just love people watching. I love beer. I love sitting on a patch, watching people, listening to live music. It's my favourite thing to do. I love not having to be clean, having to brush my hair, weeing in a corner. I do not mind any of it. I actually love that I don't have to make any effort or feel, because I do struggle to look put together, because it's just not my go-to.
Really?
It's not my go-to, looking put together.
So where? How would you be most comfy?
Oh, in a tracksuit.
Tracksuit, hair scraped back.
Yeah.
No
tracksuit, headband, no makeup whatsoever. Probably laying in the garden. doing something in the garden, watching the kids do cartwheels, doing cartwheels with them. Something that is, I'd probably have my hair tied up out the way or something, but just no maintenance whatsoever.
And so when you're in that state, what do you think and what do you feel when you see yourself in the mirror?
What, when I'm like that?
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to look in mirrors at all. I'm not that person that walks past mirrors and looks. And if I do, I will just laugh. Because I'm like, oh my God, if only people knew. But I don't look too much different.
No, you don't.
Even if I'm looking scruffy and whatnot, I just, you know, I'm fine with it. Like, I will go to the shop in slippers and in tracksuit bottoms. And whereas my husband would never do that. He's like, I can't go out like this. I'm like, who cares what we look like? No one's looking at us. They're too busy looking at themselves, like, or worrying about themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite often the case. Everyone's so busy worrying about themselves and no one really gives a shit what
I'm wearing. Everyone's got their own shit going on.
Everyone has. Like, I am not the centre of attention in the room, or nor would I want to be. I like to be the person in the corner, especially if it's a night out. I'll be in the corner watching, or I'll be in a field, laying on the floor, holding hands with my friends, just listening to music, drinking beer. I am that person.
Well, I've loved having you as the centre of attention. Loved it.
Thank you.
Nick Chapman, thank you. Nick Chapman Haste, I should say.
No, you don't have to. I never know which is right.
You're Nick Chapman Haste on Instagram.
Am I okay?
I think so. Nicola Chapman Haste, it has been so lovely having you on. What a treat. One of my favourite people. As we alluded several times in the conversation to Nick's sister Sam, there is an episode in the archive you can listen to where Sam talks about lots of the same themes from a different perspective. And there are lots of other really cool, brilliant women in the archives if you want to go back and listen. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening or watching, and we'll see you next time with another great guest. Lots of love. Bye.
Thank you.
Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.